Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, October 31st, 2017. Leaders from Abyei are asking presidents of Sudan and South Sudan to settle the dispute over the area.
Sudan knows that if you go back to voting, it will be the same results. South Sudan knows that if you go for voting, it will be the same results. So if they want to repeat the exercise as they know the results, we know it will be the same. People will not change their mind at all.
And a South Sudanese young man is using games for peace building.
Video games are a very good tool of entertainment. And the youth actually love them, they play them. There are a lot of, you know, video games that are for war. There are a lot of video games that are, you know, there are so many types of video games. So I realized that using video games as a tool of preaching peace would be a very good way to, you know, to target the 73% of the population.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Today marks the fourth anniversary of the Abyei unilateral referendum in which the Ngok Dinka in the disputed region voted overwhelmingly to become part of South Sudan. Leaders from Ngok Dinka and Abyei residents are calling on the leaders of Sudan and South Sudan to resolve the final status of Abyei when they meet in Khartoum for a presidential summit tomorrow. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Juba.
Abyei Chief Administrator Kwal Arop Kwal says for the past 4 years, the two leaders have neither recognized the results of the referendum or did anything to resolve the dispute. In October 31, 2013, unilateral referendum, 99.8% of the Dinka Ngok people who cast their ballot voted to join the Republic of South Sudan. Kwal says time is long overdue for the two leaders to resolve the Abyei dispute, so the area's residents can move on with their lives.
Even though we are not, all of us, we are not aware of what is going to be discussed in the summit, but if the issue of Abyei can come up, the two presidents at least amicably agreed over the unilateral referendum, and that is the message the people of Abyei want.
Kwal also wants the African Union and the UN Security Council to pressure the two leaders to resolve the final status of Abyei. Abyei Finance Administrator Maloyne Tong Ngor believes the international community is tired of seeing the two countries' failure to resolve their dispute over Abyei. Tong insists the Ngok Dinka community has not regrets about voting to become part of South Sudan.
Sudan knows that if you go back to voting, it will be the same results. South Sudan knows that if you go for voting, it will be the same results. International community also knows that if you go for voting again, it will be the same results. So if they want to repeat the exercise as they know the results, we know it will be the same. People will not change their mind at all.
Tong says, although neither Khartoum nor Juba have recognized the results of the referendum, the Ngok Dinka people are determined to be part of South Sudan. Malwal Yak, a traditional leader from Abyei who resides in Juba, says his community feels marginalized by both Sudan and South Sudan governments, adding the two countries have forgotten the rights of the people of Abyei. Speaking in Arabic, Yak urged South Sudan President Salva Kiir and Sudan President Omar al-Bashir to pay attention to the suffering of the people of Abyei.
Since we fought it in the referendum up to now, we keep on losing between 15 to 20 people every year. Our cattle have been looted and the whole area is not stable at all. We have not experienced any stability. The ongoing conflict in South Sudan also has affected our people in Abyei.
Ayen Nyuat, who is from Abyei but resides in Juba, says the Abyei people often feel embarrassed whenever they participate in community events in South Sudan. Speaking in Arabic, Nyuat says it bothers her that even South Sudanese citizens do not recognize the Abyei people as South Sudanese.
In our conversations in many gatherings as women, they keep on telling us that the people of Abyei are not yet recognized and we are not fully citizens of South Sudan. We feel embarrassed. We feel as if we are in a foreign country.
ABA Chief Administrator Kwal is appealing to the international community, the African Union and IGAD to resolve the long simmering dispute over ABA.
We request from the international community as well as the UN, the AU, the IGAD and other Samaritan parties to organize this referendum and give the people of Abia right to join the South as came in the result.
Thousands of people turned up in Abia town today to mark the fourth anniversary of the referendum, in which the overwhelming majority of residents who took part voted to become part of South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
An official with the French charity ACTED, which provides assistance to IDPs at a UN Protection of Civilian Sites in Juba, says angry internally displaced persons destroyed the agency's office last week during a visit by U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley. ACTED country director says his staff has not been able to access the camp since the incident took place because of security concerns. Nabil Biagio has more for VOA from Juba.
IDPs inside the camp accuse ACTED staff of denying them the chance to meet Ambassador Haley in person last Wednesday during her visit to the Protection of Civilians, or POC, site in Juba. ACTED country director Robert Simpson says his agency was only facilitating Haley's visit to the camp for 45 minutes and had very little control over the arrangement of her visit, including when the U.S. ambassador was supposed to arrive or leave.
After a certain amount of time, with the trip already coming to a close, the decision was taken by the embassy to remove Ambassador Nikki Haley so she could make her planned flight out of South Sudan. Following this departure, there were some ACTED staff, some U.S. Embassy staff who remained in the POC, and as a result of the demonstration becoming a little more agitated and some threats being made to staff, it was necessary to remove the staff that we had present in the POC from that environment. Following our departure, ACTED office was destroyed by some members of this demonstration.
Simpson says, as of now, ACTED has no office to operate from inside the POC camp. He says he understands that many IDPs wanted to meet Haley and express their concerns.
There is always interest when an outsider with influence enters this environment, and with such a large camp and so many people wanting to express certain opinions and a limited time available during the schedule, it's possible that there were frustrations around not being able to communicate all of the things that wanted to be communicated.
Simpson denies accusations by some IDPs that ACTED brought a woman from outside the camp to represent them instead of allowing Haley to meet actual IDPs.
ACTED, as facilitators of the visit, didn't really have so much control over the composition of the schedule of the visit. It's our role to greet, to move around the camp, to contribute to the security, to ensure that Ambassador Haley has a good sense of life inside the POC. As you can imagine, with any high-level visit from any person in any environment, the level of control over the schedule comes from way above the agency invited to facilitate. And regrettably, people who felt that they had opinions they wanted to share may not have got the chance to address those opinions directly to Ambassador Haley.
Other IDPs accuse ACTED of not wanting them to meet Haley because they were dressed in tattered clothes and looked miserable. While Simpson says that was not the case, he admits the IDPs have legitimate grievances about their living conditions.
The grievances that have been raised following the incident, some of which were directly related to the visit of Ambassador Haley, others completely unrelated to the visit of Ambassador Haley, are all legitimate grievances. And as camp management agency, we have a responsibility to listen to those grievances and also work to resolve them. Unfortunately, the method of airing those grievances chosen was a violent demonstration and destruction of property. So it becomes a lot more complicated for us to now address those grievances directly.
Simpson says ACTED is willing to listen to any concerns the IDPs have about their living conditions and will do its best to address them.
We can't deny that life inside the POC, or in fact any collective settlement in South Sudan or indeed any other country, is complicated and difficult. Our role as camp management agency is to empathize with people in that situation and support them to access the services and resources that they need. If there are issues faced by the population inside the POC, it is our responsibility as ACTED to hear and to try to address those issues, even though we as ACTED are not directly responsible for the service provision.
Simpson says ACTED coordinates with partners who provide the services. Since Wednesday's violent demonstration, ACTED has talked to UN officials, donors, and other partners to resolve the situation, and will soon talk with IDPs to resolve the issue.
We're very willing to engage in a direct dialogue to explain very clearly what we had control over and what we didn't, and also try and remove ourselves from any allegation of not wanting to facilitate this visit.
Simpson says ACTED's main priority now is to rebuild relationships that have been damaged with those in the camp in the safest way possible. He says the French charity will ask for a complete list of the grievances the IDPs have and work hard to address them. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
Video games have largely been used for entertainment, but one young South Sudanese man thinks they could serve a larger purpose, that is, peace building. 23-year-old Lual Mayen developed Junub Games last year to bridge the divide among South Sudanese communities. He tells Ayen Bior that the outbreak of violence in Juba over a year ago inspired him to come up with a new and unique way of peace building.
What I thought was to bringing them together and bringing peace as a product. So video games are a very good tool of entertainment. And the youth actually love them. They play them. There are a lot of, video games that are for war. There are a lot of video games that are, there are so many types of video games. So I realized that using video game as a tool of preaching peace would be a very good way to target the 73% of the population. Even the refugees, they have nothing to do in their camp. So at the end of the day, they start fighting. They do other things. But when they have something that is going to occupy their time, and then slowly you're going to change their mindset towards each other. You're going to, change their perception in terms of peace building.
What's one of the games that you've developed so far?
Yeah, I started with Salam Game. Salam Game, it's a mobile game that actually means Arabic in English. So Salam Game is one of the games that actually involve a player to become a peacemaker. So it's more of a war game, but it's a role-playing game. What you do is that as a player, you have to protect the people. You have to destroy the bomb from killing, like your brother, your sister, actually destroying the village. So the more you do that, the more the game congratulates you as a peacemaker, and the more you earn more scores. I also have a board game because, in South Sudan, like, a lot of people have no access to, to computers, and also they have no access to mobile Android and nice phone, smartphone to play a mobile game. So I have a board game that is called Wider. Wider is an Arabic word that means unity. So, but the card game actually focus on like three things. That's the community, togetherness, and unity. So it has penalty. It's a penalty card. So when we play it and you have a card that means like it's war, and then I play it against you, and then it's actually you as a player to actually put something that is going to neutralize the war. Otherwise, it's going to affect me. So, and you have to build your community. You have to build a very big town of yourself. And then the more that war is going to affect, it is going to affect everything. I also have a game called Hate Cup. So
Hate Cup?
Hate Cup. It's what I'm working on right now. And the game is actually focusing on hate speeches because South Sudan is almost having like 64 tribes. Actually, and these same people have designed a hate speech against another tribe. So I'm trying, we are developing that game to actually, tell people that hate speeches are really so bad.
But and how exactly will the video game achieve that?
Okay, this is really good. Like, it's a penalty game. We are in collaboration with Peace Tech Lab. Peace Tech Lab has come up with almost 20 lexicon that are used at the hate speeches in South Sudan. So And what we did is that we used the lexicon. For example, I don't know, Dinkas are called MTN, and then like there's Nerwell, there is Jenge, you know, all those hate speech words. So it's a game that actually it's opposite. So if I pick up a card which is it's a hate speech, then it is going to reduce my scores. But if I pick up something that is actually peace, that is opposite to that, it's adding my score. So it's a more of a penalty game.
So you've been doing this for over a year.
Yeah.
Has there been any impact?
There are a lot of people that actually, you know, gave me that have been reacting, like even the University of Nairobi. They reacted to what I'm doing, and they were saying, like, this is really a very good cause of peace building in South Sudan. So I'm seeing like this, even we have like online, and we are also like people that are playing game in the refugee camp. We have like people getting the research and giving us the feedback, because we have to know that what we are doing is really, you know, it's really, you know, giving good to the people and to the community.
So just moving forward, what are you hoping that Junoob Games will grow into?
Yeah, actually, when I started this, I thought like it was just more of a peace building stuff. But right now, you know, we really develop like our mind and expanding. My main focus right now is not just targeting South Sudan. We have been in contact with Colombia and also Syria. So I really want to make this game more of a peace building game, not only targeting South Sudan, but the war affected areas. Peace is not all about war and everything, even families. So I want this game to be played all over the world in different sectors. And I'm so happy that most of the game developers are actually joining me at the moment because this is something new in the game industry. The game industry is really big, and it's really big, but peace game have not been existing before. So we are really working hard and make Junoob game, like starting from Junoob game to the world. So we have that courage that we are going to make it.
That's Lual Mayen, a South Sudanese founder of Junoob Games. He was speaking to Ayen Bior from our studio here in Washington. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. What is Kenya's opposition leader saying about last week's presidential rerun election? Find out when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what's the most important life lesson you would want your children to learn?
That anything you are given, you shouldn't see it as little, because it's when you do your best for the little you have, that's when you get more opportunities.
Yeah, it is good to learn traditional dance and to keep on our children also to know how our traditional dance is.
I would like to teach them about integrity, that is doing the right thing even when nobody is watching. At the end of the day, you'll be rewarded.
And I would like them to be very good citizens and very responsible, of course, with a career. Just naturally, everybody is born to be responsible, to be doing something. I think it wouldn't be wise for someone to live and is hopeless.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. In our today's health segment, we take a look at antenatal care in Kenya. A Kenyan university student has won a $100,000 research grant for an idea aimed at decreasing maternal and infant deaths among cattle-raising families on the Kenya-Ethiopia border. Dahabo Abdi Galgalo secured the 2017 Innovation Award from the Alliance for Accelerating Excellence in Science in Africa for designing a GPS-like device to track expectant mothers in the area and ensure they seek health care for themselves and their babies. Born into a pastoralist family in Kenya's Marsabit County, Dahabo told VOA Horn of Service that she always wanted to improve health care for families in the border area who depend on raising and selling livestock to make a living. She said the area of the pastoral community is so vast, the hospitals and health workers are very few. In fact, Marsabit County is among the top counties in Kenya in maternal and infant death. One of the key factors she believes contributes to the high death rates is a lack of antenatal care for pregnant women. Antenatal care clinics providing prenatal services are few and far in the area, and pastoralists don't often visit the ones that do exist, partly because of long distances they would have to cover. Dahabo says in 2015, she conducted a study of mothers who gave birth at a regional hospital. Out of 1,042 mothers who delivered during the one-year period, she says 116 lost their babies during delivery. Of those 116 women, she says 40% had never gone to an antenatal clinic. And those who did make a visit often traveled 50 to 80 kilometers to receive checkups and treatment. That's when my idea of going mobile came to mind, Dahabo says. Her brainstorm was to give expectant mothers a GPS-like device to help healthcare workers track them, remind them to get proper antenatal care, and arrange a visit with a doctor or healthcare volunteer. The solar-powered device, which she designed, is the size of a coin and designed to be worn on a bracelet. With this, we can track the expectant mothers wherever they are and give them treatment, she says. Under the Hubbard's and Vision system, the program would be centered at the Moyale Regional Hospital and would cover the majority of Marsabit County with a radius of 160 kilometers. The program aims to reach up to 200 expectant mothers for an initial period of 2 years. The Dahabo has been involved in research and control of disease for more than 10 years in the Kenyan Ministry of Health. She is among 8 African inventors who have received research grants. Still in Kenya, Kenyan opposition leader Raila Odinga says last week's presidential poll was what he called sham election that must not be allowed to stand, and is urging supporters to exercise their right to protest. But Odinga did not outline specific legal action in a speech Tuesday. His first public response to the announcement that President Uhuru Kenyatta had won re-election. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
From the start of his speech, Raila Odinga dismissed the election results that showed President Uhuru Kenyatta winning a second term with about 98% of the overall vote.
Ladies and gentlemen, the meaningless exercise, a charade purported to be an election, is now behind us. Today, we return to the hard but essential task of making elections count and democracy work in Kenya.
Odinga announced the establishment of what he called a People's Assembly, through which the opposition would exercise the solemn duty of restoring democracy, constitutionalism, and the rule of law.
So we will guard our right to dissent by exercising it. We will continue to assemble, demonstrate, to picket, and to present petitions to public authorities as often as we choose.
Voter turnout was about 39% this time, much lower than the roughly 80% in the original August election. The Supreme Court nullified Kenyatta's victory in those polls, ruling the Electoral Commission had not followed electoral law and the Constitution. Odinga called for a boycott in the rerun election, saying his demands for several members of the commission to step down, polls to be postponed beyond the 60-day deadline, and other so-called irreducible minimums had not been met. Monday, President Kenyatta said his victory was part of a process that would likely again be subjected to a test through the courts. He also said that he would submit to this constitutional path, no matter its outcomes. The International Crisis Group's Kenya analyst, Morithi Mutiga, agrees there will likely be a court challenge, which he believes will probably be mounted by civil society.
But this remains more a political than legal crisis. And the cards are in the hands of the major politicians who command such support with broad sections of the public. It's true that many might have expected something more dramatic from Odinga, but we don't know what will come down the road. And of course, the People's Assembly idea at this stage has not been clearly spelled out. We need to wait and see what that will mean.
Police have been accused of using excessive force, primarily in some Nairobi slums and in the western city of Kisumu, against pro-Odinga demonstrators. The country's police service denies these allegations, saying officers have done what is necessary to protect people and property. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
From Nairobi, we move to Cameroon, where the UN Refugee Agency says it is making contingency plans in Nigeria to care for possible influx of tens of thousands of Anglophone Cameroonian refugees. Unrest is growing in English-speaking part of Cameroon amid tensions with the French-speaking majority. Lisa Schlein has this report for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency estimates 5,000 Cameroonians have fled to southeastern Nigeria following a crackdown against protesters in the Anglophone community. But UNHCR spokesman Baba Baloche tells VOA he fears that number will swell, so preparations are underway to assist growing numbers of refugees.
UNHCR is working with the Nigerian authorities, readying assistance for at least up to 40,000 who may be forced to flee Cameroon. Colleagues think it may be a conservative estimate. There could be more people who could flee Cameroon into Nigeria.
Deadly protests erupted in Cameroon nearly 1 year ago when members of the English-speaking community began demonstrating against their marginalization by the dominant French-speaking authorities. The situation in the country has continued to worsen. Early this month, at least 8 people reportedly were shot dead by soldiers in 2 English-speaking regions. Baloche says the UNHCR and Nigerian authorities have registered about 2,000 Cameroonians who have fled to different locations in southeastern Nigeria. He says another 3,000 are waiting to be registered so they too can receive food and other assistance. He says aid workers are bracing for more arrivals as many people might be trapped in forests on the Cameroonian side as they attempt to cross the border. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
That's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Morina Opidri by Lanson Lee.
Lanson Lee, hey. Lanson Lee, the new generation man. Opie Kwenidi, Karudu Waiyai. Opie Kwenmanini. Leave out the studios.
Morina Opidri.
We have been listening to Lanson Lee with the song Morina Opidri. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. We would like to know what you think about our show. You can reach us at southsudan@voanews.com. You can also find us on our Facebook site, South Sudan in Focus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.